Welcome to Culturetopia, NPR's roundup of the week's very best arts and cultural stories. I am Neda Ulaby. This week on Culturetopia, the films Young Adult and We Need to Talk About Kevin could hardly be more different. One's tragic, the other's comic, but at center, they're both about the same modern malady, the life that has not turned out as planned. A look at the TV trend that presents the American South through one durable old stereotype, the so-called redneck. And a remembrance of Harry Morgan, who played one of television's most beloved commanding officers, Colonel Sherman T. Potter from MASH. But first,
turn on the TV and there's a better and better chance that you will find an unscripted so-called reality TV show focused on eccentric characters south of the Mason-Dixon line. As TV critic Eric Deggans explains, these shows often hinge on exploiting the biggest stereotypes about working-class Southern people.
Oklahoma hand fisherman Skipper Bivens is obviously a man who enjoys his work.
I catch big old catfish using nothing but my bare hands and feet.
Bivens is the star of Animal Planet's Hillbilly Hand Fishing, a so-called reality TV show that turns on a few handy stereotypes about rural, white working class people from the South. Let's call it, for lack of a better term, redneck TV.
I've lived on this place just about all my life. I've been hunting wild boars since the 1960s, and I'll do it until the day I die.
Over on A&E, American Hogger centers on the Campbell family and their business, hunting down feral hogs in Texas. Patriarch Jerry Dean Campbell seems cut from a Rooster Cogburn movie, an ex-Texas Ranger with a sidearm and battered cowboy hat.
5,500 acres of nothing but no good, mean, aggressive, wild hog.
More than anything, these series feed an odd sort of racial stereotype. They're hard partying, not particularly intellectual, and connected to the land in ways we Yankees can only guess. Real-life descendants of the Dukes of Hazzard, who wave around the rebel flag and embrace the term redneck as a badge of honor. Which explains the titles for some of these shows. CMT's My Big Redneck Wedding and Redneck Riviera, a show gathering buzz as a southern fried Jersey Shore. And when the National Geographic Channel built a show around Alabama rocket scientist Travis Taylor, guess what they named it? Rocket City Rednecks.
Well, Daddy, we're about to get in this submarine, unload it, and give her a whirl. What do you think?
Patriarch Charles Taylor was one of NASA's original machinists. But here, he frets about a homemade submarine his son and grandson have built.
We're here getting ready to put the sub in the water, and we've made a lot of improvements on it. But hey, this is still a fertilizer tank and a bunch of beer kegs when you really get down to it.
Even when these guys have PhDs in aerospace engineering, the show makes them sound like extras in a hee-haw skit. Even worse, all this hokum comes from a traditional source of great documentaries like History and the National Geographic Channel. They show a South with no people of color, and weirdly lacking contact with sophisticated southern cities such as Atlanta or Dallas. I guess it's tough to play the bumpkin card when you're looking at skyscrapers and a booming technology corridor. It helps to think of reality TV shows as situation comedies for a new generation. And every TV fan knows sitcoms depend on stereotypes to fuel their best jokes. On these shows, decades of stereotypes about the South have risen again, ready to make a new generation laugh at the expense of real understanding. Despite reality TV's tendency to stupefy everything it touches, perhaps it's time for these programs to actually get real and give us a vision of Southern culture that reaches beyond the fun-loving redneck.
Eric Deggans is TV and media critic for the St. Petersburg Times.
Hollywood is in awards season overdrive. There are potential Oscar nominees everywhere you look, and that includes two actresses who already have Oscars in movies opening this weekend, Charlize Theron in the comedy Young Adult, and Tilda Swinton in the drama We Need to Talk About Kevin. Our film critic Bob Mondello says their performances are the best thing about both pictures.
Forget Kevin, we need to talk about his mom. As played by Tilda Swinton, Eva has been just barely holding it together, almost from the moment her son was born. He cried so much as an infant that to escape the sound of his shrieking, Eva took him for walks near construction sites. As Kevin grows up, he stops crying and starts doing other things, mostly unpleasant, often directed at his mother. But he's a cagey kid by his teens, and no one else, including her husband, understands why Eva's frightened of him, even when accidents start to endanger his younger sister.
You were supposed to be looking after her.
We just don't want you to blame yourself.
No, I don't. I mean, I never said I did.
She's gonna need a glass eye, Kevin.
So, we would appreciate you looking out for her and any name-calling.
You don't really remember being a kid much, do you, Dad? Celia's just gonna have to suck it up.
Though the film leaps around in time, that scene, for instance, is a flashback, you're never in doubt that Kevin's a sociopath. Grieving parents scream at Eva, kids splatter red paint on her house. You'll wonder about the what's and why's, but We Need to Talk About Kevin is less a horror story about a malicious kid than a study of his mom's increasing panic that it might be her less-than-motherly feelings for him that have turned him monstrous. Director Lynn Ramsey underlines Eva's fears with a lot of blood-red imagery, glasses of Cabernet, oozing jelly sandwiches, a supermarket panic attack in front of a wall of tomato soup cans. You'd get the point without all the pointing, but the film's bluntness doesn't diminish the power of the nature versus nurture questions Eva's asking herself, or of Swinton's harrowing portrait of parental guilt. Guilt may be the one thing not felt by Charlize Theron's homewrecker Mavis in the comedy Young Adult. Mavis is a former prom queen who, at 37, makes her living writing teen fiction and seems to think she can actually live the sort of win my high school boyfriend back storyline that she might write for one of her characters.
Here's the deal. Buddy Slade and I are meant to be together, and I'm here to get him back.
I'm pretty sure he's married with a kid on the way.
No, kid's here. I'm cool with it. I mean, I've got baggage, too.
Mavis's peers may have graduated to jobs and marriage, but she still sees the world in terms of cliques and boyfriends. It was a birth announcement from Buddy and his wife that prompted a return to her hometown and some ill-advised fantasizing.
You can come to the city with me like we always planned.
Mavis, I'm a married man.
No, we can beat this thing together.
Charlize Theron won her Oscar for Monster, a much darker character study than this film, and screenwriter Diablo Cody won hers for Juno, a much sunnier comedy. So it makes sense that Young Adult feels like a mashup of styles and genres. In a less acid romp, Mavis would learn life lessons in the final reel, but director Jason Reitman makes it a point not to let her off the hook. The big city life she's carved out for herself may look glamorous to the folks back home, but she's miserable. Her expensive condo a pigsty, her career a joke, her social and romantic prospects non-existent, and all of it is her fault. She's arrived at what ought to be maturity, as ugly on the inside as she is gorgeous on the outside. She is also, and this is what makes Young Adult catch you up short, hauntingly alone at a point in life when she didn't expect to be. You could also say that about Tilda Swinton's Eva in We Need to Talk About Kevin. The films could hardly be more different, one tragic, the other comic. But at center, they're both about the same modern malady, the life that hasn't turned out as planned. I'm Bob Mundell.
One of television's most beloved commanding officers has died. Harry Morgan, who played Colonel Potter on MASH, died today at the age of 96. As NPR's Neda Ulaby reports, Morgan brought an avuncular authority to a show about the absurdity and horror of war.
MASH was funny, one of the best satires on television, about doctors cracking wise in an army medical unit during the Korean War.
I always look forward to the fall when the new line of weapons comes out.
It was often Harry Morgan as Colonel Potter who provided the moral outrage.
Every month there's a new procedure we have to learn because somebody's come up with an even better way to mutilate the human body. Tell me this, Captain. How the hell am I supposed to keep up with it?
I'm only...
If they can invent better ways to kill each other... Why can't they invent a way to end this stupid war?
Colonel Potter was decent, sympathetic, and he embodied a kind of folksy middle American sensibility. Take this moment when a higher officer is trying to strong-arm Potter into letting a talented, wounded marksman back into the field.
Chandler will be able to return to action a couple of days.
Good.
But it takes more than four sound legs to make a stallion run. It takes a sound heart and a sound mind.
It was one of those one-of-a-kind fits of character to actor to role, and they all served each other's needs.
James Poniewozik is the television critic for Time magazine.
He just seemed and carried himself like the last reasonable man in the middle of craziness.
A couple of days ago, somebody asked me if I thought MASH had made me a better actor.
In 1983, Harry Morgan spoke at a press conference about the ending of a series so beloved the last show drew a record 125 million viewers.
And I said, I didn't know about that, but I know it's made me a better human being. And there aren't many shows you can say that about.
Morgan alluded to his long career as a character actor, playing on Broadway, movies, and the TV show Dragnet before he got cast on MASH during its fourth season.
I've done about 100 movies plus, and this is my eighth television series. And believe me, in my experience, there's never been a congregation of actors put together that would come within a mile of this bunch.
I was holding this paper that said, Klinger is hereby declared nuts. Signed, Colonel Potter.
Jamie Farr played Corporal Klinger, the obnoxious cross-dressing company clerk. He had a ton of scenes with Harry Morgan, and he says even in a cast filled with cut-ups, Morgan was infamous for being funny.
Oh, he was terrible. He was absolutely the worst. I mean, I wish you could see some of the outtakes. We have some great ones.
Farr says he spent most of the day exchanging emails and phone calls with members of the cast. He says Mike Farrell, who played B.J. Honeycutt, was a huge presence in Harry Morgan's last days. He kept everyone updated from the hospice with emails. The last one he sent today said Harry Morgan died today around 3 a.m., peacefully and in his sleep. Netta Ulipi, NPR News.
Anita Desai's new collection of stories, The Artist of Disappearance, reads a bit like three symphonic movements in a minor key. They're three novellas set in modern India, in which the past is giving way. In one story, a government official inspects the forgotten treasures left behind in a faded mansion till he finds a huge treasure living on borrowed time. In another story, a translator becomes a little too creative. And in the third, a man living in solitude finds his world upset by roving visitors. There are no car chases or explosions, but the drama of people confronting themselves. Anita Desai, who's written more than a dozen novels and collections and has been shortlisted three times for the Booker Prize, joins us from New York. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for asking me.
The first story, Museum of Final Journeys, there's a civil servant who's called in to appraise an old collection of antiquities, and they're, with some exceptions, not works of art per se. They're globes and travel posters and stuffed birds and lizards and masks and daggers and scrolls and bells and clocks long broken. And he calls it, wrote down this wonderful phrase, this gloomy storehouse of abandoned, disused, decaying objects I wanted only to break free and flee. Is there a theme in there about the different ways people have of looking at the past?
To tell you the truth, I thought of that story all in about 5 minutes when I was walking through a museum that was just like it, the Museum of Oriental Art in Venice. Mm-hmm. Apparently an Italian aristocrat had set out and traveled in the East and sent back all these treasures. And yet, having been removed from where they belonged, where they'd been made, they had lost the quality of life. They all were just objects, shut up in glass cases, which made me wonder, what makes people collect such objects? What can it mean to anyone? So I was also thinking about the pointlessness of it all, the futility of trying to recreate other countries, other histories, other paths.
Your second story, a teacher, a professor named Purma Joshi, translates a novel from an Indian language, and she kind of likes the power that she enjoys. She finishes a session of translation, and it makes her sort of see the world differently when she walks back out into the street. What changed her?
Well, this is a story based very much on the translators I have known myself and heard other writers talk of, and I realized that all translators, they all long to be writers and themselves. If they didn't have that longing, they probably wouldn't be very good translators. But a lot of them do have that creative urge. And my character, Prema Joshi, simply gets carried away with that.
This inevitably raises the question as to whether you've ever encountered one of your works being translated by a translator who, in your mind, took too many liberties.
I can't quote from my own experience, but I know my daughter being told that a very, very funny book that she wrote, her very first book, the kind of book which makes you laugh out loud, when it was translated into some of the Scandinavian languages, didn't make anyone laugh at all. There was no humor left in it whatsoever.
You mentioned your daughter, who, of course, is Kiran Desai, an accomplished novelist and Booker Prize winner. What did you tell her about writing, looking back on it?
I didn't dare tell her anything. All my children told me they never wanted to become writers. They said, you lead such a boring life, we don't want to live the way you do. And even Kiran just fought against the idea of writing. I used to tell her, she writes such wonderful letters, why doesn't she do more with that? And she would always say no. But she went to a very good college, and the professors there encouraged her to write. Like me, they saw she had that spark in her. This was what she should really have been doing. Now, of course, we both write in the same house, and it's wonderful to be able to talk about our work, about each other's work, about the books we're reading.
Oh, what a blessing that is for a mother and daughter to be able to do that.
Oh, yes, it is.
Let me ask you about the final story in this collection. It's the title story, The Artist of Disappearance. You have a character, Ravi, who is living what we would call a hermit-like existence. He's been working on a kind of splendid rock sculpture hidden in the Himalayan foothills, and then a movie crew from Delhi comes to visit. And they see things differently, I think it's safe to say. What's the difference between Ravi and the people, the film people?
I think Ravi, as you say, is something of a hermit, and he's never really entered the adult world. And he retains that child's point of view. He never thinks of himself as an artist. He has no desire to reveal it to the outer world. He simply doesn't have those adult impulses or ambitions. The television crew that comes up from Delhi, of course, is totally different. They belong to two different worlds.
Well, for me, this story raised the question, is there art without an audience?
I think the audience is quite certain that there isn't, that the art only becomes art once it is looked upon as such. But in my experience, there are artists who have done things entirely for themselves, and the audience is unimportant and often destructive to their vision. But all of us who've ever written, composed music, painted, know that when we perform these acts, we are not in touch with the world. We are completely withdrawn from it, and in our own world, we are recreating an inner world.
Mr. Desai, awfully good speaking with you. Thanks so much.
Thank you for asking me.
Anita Desai, her new book of three novellas is The Artist of Disappearance.
Do we have a second to just double check?
Most rock bands that visit NPR take a fair bit of time tuning up before the interview. But Miracles of Modern Science took it to a whole new level. Miracles of Modern Science is a rock band with all the trappings of a chamber music ensemble. Strings are the band's driving force. They arrived with a violin, upright bass, and cello in tow. Yes, there is a drummer, but if you're waiting to hear the electric guitar tune up, don't bother. There isn't one.
Godspeed.
The closest they'll come is an amped-up mandolin. The members of Miracles of Modern Science met in college. They all come from different musical backgrounds. Rock, jazz, classical.
Oh, yeah.
What they share is a healthy dose of goofiness.
That's so loud and so annoying.
Woo! Here's how it breaks down. There are five miracles, so to speak. Evan Younger sings and plays the upright bass. Jeff McDonald plays the cello and Josh Hirschfeld the mandolin. Kieran Ledwidge is the violinist. Tyler Pines is the group's drummer. Their debut album is called Dog Year, and we asked them to perform it for us in Studio 4A a couple of weeks ago. The song they just performed is called Mom's Away. That song makes me want to, like, run around in a field screaming or, like, being in love. I love that song. I love that
Thank
song.
You. Feel free.
What's the reaction that you get from people when you roll up in the club with the cello case or the mandolin?
This is Evan. A lot of times we've gotten mistakenly booked on folk bills before. There'll be people there kind of earnestly strumming acoustic guitar, and then we get up and we're like, you're ready to rock.
Completely destroying the mood.
I think we should probably play a song. Is there one in particular you think?
Eating Me Alive, it's the first single off our album.
That my heart would be my guide. But when I asked my heart, my spleen replied. It said, don't bother with your heart, it never can decide. Stick with me, I'm better qualified. Dear, I don't know what to say. Heart says go, my spleen says stay. Insides are in disarray. There's no chance they'll meet halfway. Get more push by the day. Don't know whom to disobey. Organ from my hide. 'Cause all this indecision is eating me alive. Without my heart, could our love survive?
That was Eating Me Alive by the band Miracles of Modern Science. They're speaking to us here in Studio 4A at NPR. Kieran, halfway through that song, you do this really intense bow stringing thing. I don't know how to explain it.
Oh, the...
Explain it.
Wait, this...
Yeah. Is there a violin teacher somewhere who's cringing, or are you pushing your instrument to kind of the limits of
this? I just don't tell any of my old violin teachers about what it is that I do. No, it's a technique. It's called glissando. Ending up and finishing on the right note is a challenge, and it keeps me in line. But yeah, it's one of the tone qualities available to the instrument.
The reason why I ask is because I think of orchestral music as being about control. And rock is basically about the opposite. It's about kind of having, if anything, controlled chaos. And are there times when you push the instrument to its limit or you use it in ways that are unorthodox?
Absolutely. Well, I mean, that's the thing that's a bit deceptive, I think, is that in being very controlled, there can be a lot of energy and excitement. The techniques that you're using and executing them correctly, hopefully, creates a more intense sound. And, of course, in the heat of the moment, in the middle of a show, that... Well, who knows? But that's my mindset.
There's something when I was doing my research on you guys, I saw something that made me raise a few questions. The spacesuits. You used to wear
We'll never be
suits.
Free of this.
What happened there? What was the idea behind it? Where are they now? Because now you're wearing flannel.
Wow, you guys
use
really
your
are
imagination.
All wearing flannel, aren't you?
The flannel is off the record.
Well, for our first show ever, we... wanted to do something special, and we kind of on a whim ordered these silver spacesuit costumes off eBay. They sort of drew a crowd on their own. So our second show, we came out and we started setting up, and people started clamoring for spacesuits, and we realized we'd made a horrible mistake. But there was this ironic juxtaposition of these futuristic costumes with our sort of antique instruments. And then I guess once we graduated college, we were still wearing the spacesuits, and they were starting to deteriorate. They started to smell a bit. At one point, we bravely decided to try playing a show without them, and we found that people still liked us.
Were you nervous, though?
We were. By that point, it had been such a part of our identity. Like, we're the band with string instruments that wear spacesuits. But about that time, we realized the music could stand on its own.
One thing I haven't asked you about is lyrics. Is that okay?
The lyrics are a source of anxiety for us, I think.
How come?
I tend to procrastinate on the lyric writing process because I'm a little self-conscious about putting my emotions out there. And so we'll get to the point where we're down to the wire. We have the song all recorded. The studio time is booked, and we need to sing something, and I think under the pressure of that deadline, that's when the most emotionally honest stuff kind of comes out of me, whether I want it to or not.
As far as connecting with an audience, there's really nothing more essential than the human voice. If you're going to sing a song, it's always going to be the vocal line, and that's what people are going to just naturally gravitate towards.
While you are accomplished, the songs are effectively... stuck in my head.
Thanks.
We have one more song left, which does show off your voices a little bit and the lyrics a little bit. And it's a song called Friend of the Animals. So before we go,
Thank you, Evan Younger, on
vocals, bassist, Josh Hirschfeld on mandolin, Jeff McDonald, cellist, Kieran Ledwidge on violin, and Tyler Pines, the drummer. You are the band Miracles of Modern Science. Thank you all for coming in to play with us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Okay.
Tell me to go play dead. I will comply. I will comply. Love is a sleeping dog. Just let it lie. Let it lie.
That's it for this week. You can find links to all the stories we have today and subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. Culturetopia is produced by Mike Katziff and executive produced by Sarah Saracen. I am Netta Ulibi. Thanks for listening to Culturetopia. So long.